The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Take off my jacket and get to work. Well, it's good to be here, and it's good to see interest among socialists in agriculture. That's, I think, relatively new, maybe the last 10 years or 15 years. Not through the whole history of socialism, but in the more recent history. There hasn't been much interest in agriculture in general. Anybody can't hear me, yell. The mic works. You can't hear me. Okay, I will do that. It's called leaning in, right? Okay. We shouldn't be doing that. So what I'm going to do is, I have an article on this subject, which I'm not going to read. It is available if anybody wants it. I can send you the URL or a PDF of it. It's called a Rational Agriculture is Incompatible with Capitalism. Okay, so if you'd like to see that article, there'll be some material in it that's similar to this, but I didn't want to reproduce it. That's out there, and you can have access to it if you want it. That was Monthly Review a few years back. I can't tell you exactly when, maybe 2015. But my email address is, I can be reached, just my name, F. Magdoff at the University of Vermont, at uvm.edu. So if anybody has any questions after this also that we don't get a chance to talk about, you think about later, you can send me a note.
Is your email in your book?
No, it's not in the book. Yeah. Just F. Magdoff, F-M-A-G-D-O-F-F, at uvm.edu. This can only be an overview because of the time limitations we have, and also since we don't have overhead projectors, there's some graphics that were pretty neat that sort of really say a lot. For example, one of a hand like this with a suit jacket, all you see is the suit jacket, the striped shirt in the hand holding soil up like a field, and a campesino working on that field. And it's really a depiction of the land grabs that are going on right now, but it also could be a depiction of the enclosures of what happened in the 1700s, 1800s. Let me start off by saying that capitalism and agriculture obviously have been intertwined since its beginning, and that the enclosures in England, which is where capitalism really first started, industrial capitalism certainly, the enclosures in England where the common lands were privatized basically, where people had use rights over the land but didn't own the land, those lands were then taken, those use rights were taken away, the land was privatized, and you started to get large capitalist agricultural units of production. And at the same time, you got a labor force, because you had people who used to be able to live on the land and who now no longer could do that. And therefore, they needed to work for a wage. And they had to go to the city or the mills. Some of them were in rural areas too, the early mills. And this is what Marx called primitive accumulation. Primitive is a mistranslation, of course. It's original accumulation. This is part of the original accumulation of capital and the original accumulation of a labor force. Because without a labor force, how do you have capitalism? So you need people who have no other way to make a living except by wage labor. Okay, that's an essential part of capitalism. The process of land theft never stopped, though it took different forms, such as theft of land from the original inhabitants of the US, Canada, South Africa, and so on, Australia, and keep going. The theft of land from native peoples goes on to this day. I've already alluded to this in what's been called the 21st century land grabs. I'm not going to be talking about them, but if anybody wants, I also have a separate article on the 21st century land grabs, also a monthly review. I don't know the exact date, probably 2014 or something like that. But I'd be happy to send you the URL or the PDF of that as well. Okay, so I'm not going to be talking about that now. Okay, agriculture itself is a very large industry. And it's not just farming. People think of agriculture, they think of farming. Okay, there's a farmer out there, you know, plowing some fields. But what you have is a huge input sector. That is the industries that supply farmers with machinery, with fertilizers, with seeds, with pesticides, okay, with everything that they need to do the production. Okay. They put the labor in, but they're not doing it alone, all right? So they need these inputs in the way industrial agriculture has developed. You've got the farmer who uses the inputs, and then you've got the companies that purchase the products that farmers produce. So most farmers in the United States and most farmers in the industrialized countries produce what are called undifferentiated commodities. In other words, my corn's no different than your corn. And my milk is no more different than your milk or my tomatoes, right? They're not selling them through farmers markets. They're selling them through the generalized regional and national commodity markets. Okay, so then you have the processors who take the food that's been purchased, sometimes it's the same as purchasers, and they manufacture it and distribute it. And then, of course, you have the retail stores, and eventually it gets to the public. And all of that is the agri-food system, what's referred to as the agri-food, A-G-R-I, food system. And farming is just in the middle of that. And I'll be talking mainly about farming, but I'm going to be talking about some of the others as well. Let me just go through a few of the headlines of some articles over the last year or so on agriculture from New York Times, Bloomberg, I've forgotten where else they're from. This is from March of this year. This is just the headline, "When the death of a family farm leads to suicide." And what you're having now is very severe problems with farmers in the dairy industry because of low prices for a number of years. And suicides are becoming, I wouldn't say common, but they're becoming a problem. This is similar to what happened, though not to the same extent, in the 1980s in the Midwest, when there was a major farm crisis, which, again, I'm not planning on getting into, but I'd be happy to do so if anybody wants to. Here's another headline. This is also New York Times this year, February 5th. U.S. farmers are producing too much food. Here's why they can't stop. Okay. Now, the world, I presume everybody knows this, the world produces more than enough food to feed everybody in the world, okay? This included the year the food crisis, 2008. There was a major food crisis in 2008. I don't know if the younger people here remember that, but the prices of the basic foods like wheat and soy and oil, you know, oils like palm oil and rice went up by 40, 50, 60, 70%. Rice doubled in a period of a month. And part of this was speculation. Part of it was just the markets were a little tight. Even at that time, there was plenty of food to feed everybody. And of course, we know, I'll get back to this later, there's more than enough food in the United States than we know what to do with. So we're just trying to push it to the Chinese and other places. The Chinese have not accepted the latest shipment of soybeans because of the Trump trade war that started. Okay, at Hamburger Central, this is March of this year, New York Times also, antibiotics for cattle that aren't sick. So most of the antibiotics in the United States, most of the antibiotics that are used for farm animals, and they're used for farm animals that aren't sick. They're fed for the purpose of trying to maintain their health and have them grow faster when they are raised in confined situations, what are called factory farms. Okay, I'll come back to that a little bit. Dead zone in Gulf of Mexico, this is from March, will take decades to recover from farm pollution. So even if all farm pollution was stopped going into the Mississippi River and all its tributaries, the Gulf of the so-called dead zone, which isn't really dead, it's a low oxygen zone, will take decades to recover. Water under Colorado's eastern plains is running dry as farmers keep irrigating the Great American Desert. You know, there's an aquifer which is being just used up more and more and more. It is being used up faster than it's being replenished, and therefore the water level is going down and down. You need deeper wells, and the first people who pointed this out were referred to as communists. I mean, it's mathematics, and sort of simple, if you're drawing out more, if you have $100 in a bank account, and you're drawing out, $10 a day and putting in $1 a day, you're going to run out of money pretty quickly, right? There's nothing to do with communism or socialism or anything. It's just simple math, okay? Oh, stuff on global warming has created another crisis for farms in many parts of the world. The United Nations estimated that some 22.5 million people have been displaced by climate-related or extreme weather events. This includes famine in Darfur, monsoons and flooding in Bangladesh, the catastrophic hurricane in Puerto Rico, and let's not forget what happened in Syria, where the Syrian civil war started after 4 years of drought, which was a very, very unusual occurrence, where people, farmers from the countryside came into the cities by hundreds of thousands and millions because they could not make a living in the countryside because there was just not enough water, not enough rainfall. Okay, so what defines capitalism? For this group, I think I can do it pretty quickly. But some people say, this is a market economy. Well, there were markets before capitalism. There may be markets after capitalism. Who knows? But that's not the definition. Free markets, I've said this to people, and they look at me very quizzically. There's no such thing as free markets anymore. For free markets, you need to have a large number of buyers and a large number of sellers. That is the definition of a free market by the traditional economists. And that has disappeared as you have more and more monopoly development. And so there are fewer buyers or sellers, depending upon what you're dealing with. I can get into what I mean. Democracy, we know that capitalism does fine without democracy. It's hard to call what we have in the United States democracy. It certainly, as Stiglitz put it, who's a liberal economist, of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%. That was an article in Vanity Fair that came out before the Occupy movement started. Okay, so what's the whole point of capitalism? What's the definition, really the defining aspect, the driving force of the system? It's not the only part, but what's sort of the heart of the system? The heart of the system is you take money, capitalist, you buy labor and you buy materials, you produce something, a commodity, and you sell it for more money than you started with, okay? Or as Marx said, MCM prime. And then you took that prime, which was the extra money, and you put it through the cycle again and again and again and again. So it's the profit motive that is the driving force. It is the driving force. It is the motivating force of the whole system. This is how people make decisions. They don't make decisions on the basis of, what might be good for society? If I have a company, I can't make decisions like that. I have to make decisions because I'm in competition. Even if you're in a monopoly, you're in a competition. I mean, it's really not technically a monopoly, an oligopoly with other companies. And you have to be able to produce basically at lower and lower costs as time goes on. So the profit motive becomes the major issue. So where things are produced, how they're produced, what's produced, etc., overrides the consideration of profit, overrides everything else. And because companies and farms are functioning in a competitive environment, the greatest profits are usually gained by lowering costs, assuming quality isn't sacrificed. Producers are pushed to continually adapt new technology, mechanization, as well as other types of technology, to try to lower costs per unit of output. If they don't, they fall by the wayside, going out of business, perhaps absorbed by a more aggressive business. Regarding agriculture, the late Richard Levins said, "Agriculture is not about producing food, but about profit. Food is a side effect." Okay. So the drive for profits in a competitive system naturally leads to larger companies. This is now recognized by at least the liberal economists of the traditional bent. And you also have you have a situation where the 200 largest companies that are not financial companies sold over or had over one third of the total revenue of all non-financial companies in the United States. The top four retailers sold nearly 40% of all retail food. Walmart, which is the top, sold 25%. A quarter of the food in the United States that's sold through markets, supermarkets, sold by Walmart. Larger and larger companies, and farms, by the way, which I'll talk about, is a natural consequence of how the system functions. And they take advantage of economies of scale, which are both physical and financial. Again, there's been consolidation in the seed industry. This just happened this year even more. There used to be literally hundreds of seed companies that got consolidated in the 1980s, 90s, to early 2000s. This year you had the combination of Bayer and Monsanto, DuPont and Dow, and Syngenta and ChemChina. And they together control about something like two-thirds or more, like 60-some-odd percent, of all the seeds sold in the world. Okay, so we're talking about three seed companies and larger farms. And what you have is, we have a lot of farms in the United States, but two-thirds of all farm sales were made by less than 4% of the farms, those that had over $1 million worth of sales. Most farmers are producers of bulk, undifferentiated commodities, which they sell into these markets. Okay. Because social and ecological consequences of decisions and practices are not considered, actually if they harm the bottom line, they cannot be, unless regulations force ones to do so, there are many adverse effects on people and the wider environment. This is what economists call externalities. Things just happen. Or as they used to say, shit happens. Without somebody consciously planning or thinking that it's going to happen. And these externalities can be pretty strange. Actually, one that I don't have down here, but I want to talk about, is agriculture is the only business I know of that when prices go up, farmers produce more. Okay? Everybody knows they should do that. Should, by the definition of how economists think. When prices go down, farmers produce more. Why? And many economists don't understand this. I was with a chief economist of the USDA. When he heard this from a farmer, he said, "You're not supposed to do that." And the farmer said, "I have to do that because I have so many fixed costs. I have to produce more." So the individual decisions by many, many farmers of producing more when prices go down means that you're flooding the market and prices go down even more. So this is, even within the thinking of the capitalist system, you have an irrationality right there on the economic side. Okay, nobody sat down and said, we should have 40 some odd million people in the United States being hungry. Okay, although hunger has been abolished in the United States by the US Department of Agriculture some years ago when they stopped using the name. They would not use the word hunger, they use the term food insecurity now. Okay, hunger was too charged, it was too political, and so a decision was made to stop using the term. Okay? So nobody said that that should happen. Nobody said that some 17 million people, including 1 million children, live in homes considered to be very food insecure. But since food is a commodity, it's like any other commodity. It's like this bottle of water, or like a car, or like whatever it is, whatever commodity you want to think of. If you have the money to buy it, you can buy it. If you don't have the money to buy it, you can't buy it. If you have to pay rent, pay electricity, pay for other costs, or your kids' clothing, or whatever, you may not have enough money left over to buy enough food for everyone in the household. So this is not anything that anybody planned out, okay? It's what happens in capitalism. No farmer plans to throw away a portion of their crop because it doesn't meet certain size or other standards. And this is with the produce industry, you know, the fruit and vegetables. If you don't meet a certain standard, it's not accepted into the supply chain, and therefore you have to throw it out. According to a report in 2012 by the Natural Resources Defense Council, one large cucumber farmer estimated that fewer than half the vegetables he grows actually leave the farm, and 75% of the cucumbers culled before sale are edible, but they're not the right size, or they don't look nice. No one planned to create a rift in the cycling of nutrients, okay, going around into plants and animals and going back to the land, that caused an increased reliance on fertilizers at the same time that excess nutrients accumulate on factory farms and in the cities. It happened as a consequence of the system, okay? So when you have a situation where you raise all your animals over here, I'm talking mainly about poultry and hogs or pigs, and you bring the feed from over there, you've created a rift in the nutrient cycling, as you do, as Marx pointed out, when people move into the cities and the human waste is not put back on the land. That is a rift that Marx talks about in volume one and refers to in other places as well. No one thought it would be a good idea to have widespread water pollution with fertilizers. But it happens as a natural consequence of the system that they're using. And I'm going to use just an example of the corn and soybean system in the Midwest. If you go to Iowa, Illinois, places like that, 90 some odd percent of the land is in either corn or soybeans in any one year. There's some other farms there doing other things, but that's basically it. This is a very simplified system. This is not really a true crop rotation. It's also a very leaky system with regard to nitrogen. Nitrates leak out of that very easily. And you can have huge quantities going down the rivers. The city of Des Moines actually sued upriver conservation districts because they have to take the nitrate out of the water before they can give it to people, put it in their system for drinking water if it goes above a certain level. I made a calculation that some 100 million pounds of nitrogen were traveling by Des Moines, just going down the river, coming from upriver. This is the Raccoon River, by the way, which flows into some other river, which flows into the Mississippi, which flows down to the Gulf of Mexico. 9 of the 11 million tons of nitrogen that make it to the dead zone come from fertilizer and manure. Okay, so if this is excessive use of fertilizer, excess of concentration of animals, you have these huge amounts of nutrients that just go on down. Okay, no one planned that there should be widespread contamination of the environment with pesticides. Groundwater, farmers and farm workers, the food that you eat is contaminated, carcinogens, endocrine disruptors, etc. No one selected these chemicals to have serious detrimental effects on organisms, pollinators, humans, or others. They were just an easy way to deal with pests in a very simplified system. Okay, we know how to grow food without pesticides. Okay, but this is a very simplified system. It's not complex. Pests do very well in simplified systems for reasons I'd be happy to talk about. Nobody said, how can we figure out how to treat farm workers and those who work in the ag processing industry, like slaughterhouses, inhumanely. I mean, let's figure out how inhumanely we can treat people. No. What they wanted to do is to see how cheaply we can pay them, how fast we can make them work, speed up the line in the slaughterhouses, which is one of the problems causing a lot of injuries, etc. It all had to do with profits. It's the goal is profits, then you have this inhumane treatment of human beings. The same thing happens with animals. So how cruel can we be with an animal? How cruel can we be with a pig? Keep it in its crate, the sow, and have the piglets suckle on it, and the sow can't even turn around. How cruel can we be? No, that wasn't the question. The question was, how cheaply, how fast can we get pigs to market? That was the question. Okay? When that's the question, those are the types of answers you get. When that is the driving force, that is how you end up with that type of situation. So larger and larger farms are occurring now, even in the Midwest. When I was in ag school, out studying in graduate school, a 640-acre farm out in Iowa was a good-sized farm. Nowadays, that's nothing. If you don't have a couple thousand acres, you're nothing. And there's a fellow who's got 20,000-acre farm. This is quoted in the article, by the way, on capitalism and agriculture. He says, previously, a Corn Belt farmer with 1,000 acres could make a good living. I'm not sure that's going to last. So anyway. Nobody said, how can we develop a really poor rotation of crops? They just went after what was going to be most profitable. And let me just give you a quote from Marx on this very issue, by the way. The dependence of the cultivation of particular agricultural products upon the fluctuation of market prices and the continual changes in this cultivation with these price fluctuations, the whole spirit of capitalist production, which is directed toward the immediate gain of money, are in contradiction to agriculture, which has to minister to the entire range of permanent necessities of life required by the chain of successive generations. What a wonderful quote. And he certainly hit the nail on the head. You also have, excuse me, because of the power that goes along with large companies, large farms, large farm organizations, you have things that happen which are completely irrational. Why are we growing so much corn in the United States? Okay. Why? One of the reasons is 40% of the corn, approximately a third to 40% of the corn, is going to feed cars, right? You know that the gasoline that you buy for a car is supposed to be, well, is 10% ethanol. It was supposed to go to 15% ethanol, but the car companies wouldn't guarantee the engines. And so it hasn't actually increased from 10%. But by law, it's supposed to be 15% by now. Where did this come from? Where did it come from? It came from a company, ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, and the director of ADM was Duane Andreas, who was friends with all the presidents from Nixon on to the present. I mean, he's dead now, so. Well, he and Trump would have gotten along pretty well, I would think. But who was he? What was ADM? ADM was buying corn, and they were processing some of it. They wanted another revenue stream. And they figured that if they could get ethanol as another revenue stream, they'd make more money. So basically, this whole ethanol mandate came because of the pushing of this one CEO of one corporation, plus other backing, of course. The National Corn Growers Association were not opposed to it. In fact, they liked it. Sure, something else to do with corn that'll help maintain corn prices, etc. Okay. So why hasn't farming been taken over like other, I'm talking about the actual farming aspect, been taken over by corporations as the rest of the economic other industries have been, and the other parts of the agri-food industry. Corporations are making plenty of money selling to, loaning to, and buying from farmers. They let the farmers commit the capital and take the risks of uncertain weather and market conditions when they are selling. Of course, the particular conditions at that moment are critical. Where's the real money in agriculture? The input industries, the processing industries, the retail industries, the banks and the insurance companies. That's where the money is. The money is not in growing food. There is speculation on land, so there has been, especially after the 2007-2009 recession, there were people who had a lot of money. They thought maybe these manufactured derivatives and stuff that were really meaningless. They had nothing. They were just bets. They were just bets about nothing. They would rather have something tangible. And so people started, and companies started buying farmland, so that what you'd have was that you'd have income from rental of the farmland, and hopefully the farmland would appreciate. So that you have situations, I'm talking about in the United States, and this is happening abroad as well, where farmers actually rent a sizable portion of their land. In the Midwest, it's something like 40%. Some of those might just be from farmers who went out of business, or widows or widowers no longer farming, but some of that now is through these private venture capitalists who bought land as a way to have a tangible asset, as opposed to these made-up, you know, assets. 10 minutes left. That's more than enough time. So one thing I wanted to point out is say, okay, capitalist agriculture drives the system in a certain direction, and there's no question about it. It's a direction of larger units of production. It's a direction of inhumane treatment of animals, inhumane treatment of people, and it's highly polluting in various ways, pesticides, nutrients, etc. But is there a way for someone to sort of, in a smaller scale, fit into this system? And there is. And so I think we should point it out. I think some of you probably know about this. I don't think it'll come as a surprise. There are farmers who are making a living, not a great living, but they're making a living on a small scale, selling into niche markets. And these can be to restaurants. It can be these, I would include in there some that sell directly to the public, like people know about CSAs, community supported agriculture farms, pretty widespread in the United States now. And so these are not capitalist farmers. These are farmers that are growing food for people. They're not growing food to make a profit. The CSA farmers are not trying to expand, right, and get larger and larger and larger, and they're not trying to end up, you know, with more and more profits. They're just trying to make a living. Hopefully they can get health insurance. Hopefully they can deal with their kids' education. It is not an easy thing to do on small scale. Also adding value. You know, farmers make yogurt or make cheese or make jams or things like that. But even that runs into problems. There's a well-known farmer in Vermont who started making yogurt years ago, one of the earliest ones. And they're having problems now because a lot of other farms have gotten into the yogurt making. And then you had the trend towards Greek yogurt, which sort of took away part of their markets. So what is a good niche market today may not be a good niche market in another 5 or 10 years. And that's just the way the system functions. Let me just quote from Michael Pollan. People know his books on food. Capitalism's genius for absorbing and integrating every challenge to it is on vivid display in this thoroughly absorbing history. This is a review of a book. Behind familiar brands like Stonyfield, which is like a hippie brand, now a subsidiary of Dannon Yogurt, Dannon, or Cascadian Farms, now part of General Mills, stand hippie ideals, as well as pioneering organic farmers. As Gene Kahn, the hippie farmer founder of Cascadian Farms, told me somewhat ruefully, after he sold his company to General Mills, everything eventually morphs into the way the world is. Right? This is what happens when you are successful, okay, in a business like that. In the food industry, another example just from my home state, from Vermont, is Ben & Jerry's. You know, really had this wonderful, you know, image, and they ended up selling out, you know, to a Swiss company. So the pulls and pushes of the capitalist system, the way it inherently develops, as all sectors strive to maximize profit, produces an agriculture in which the so-called economic bottom line takes precedence over ecological and social concerns. This does not mean that there are not some farmers that are concerned about these aspects. And some try to do things about it, but are constrained by the realities of being in a competitive system. Okay? In other words, we know how to do things better. I've got stuff on that too, if you're interested in it. We know how to grow food better and grow healthy food, large quantities, without this type of pollution. And we know how to do it without taking advantage of people and also of treating animals inhumanely. But the problem is most farmers can't do those things. They can't do it in the market system that they're in. Maybe not a free market, but it is this particular capitalist market system. The real remedy for the problems we've discussed is not to tinker with them one by one. What's needed is a different economic system, one that by the very way it functions, produces goods for the purpose of meeting the needs of all people in ways that protect the richness, integrity, and functioning of the ecosystem. And as I mentioned just previously, we know how to do it. It's not a technical issue at this point. It is an issue of how society and the economy is organized. That's the real question. Well, thank you very much.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.